Welcome to Fill the Gap, the official podcast series of the CMT Association, hosted by David Lundgren and Tyler Wood. This monthly podcast will bring veteran market analysts and money managers into conversations that will explore the interviewee's investment philosophy, their process, and decision-making tools. By learning more about their key mentors, early influences, and their long careers in financial services, Fill the Gap will highlight lessons our guests have learned over many decades and multiple market cycles. Join us in conversation with the men and women of Wall Street who discovered, engineered, and refined the discipline of technical market analysis.
Gap is brought to you with support from Optima, a professional charting and data analytics platform. Whether you're a professional analyst, portfolio manager, or trader, Optima provides advanced technical and quantitative software to help you discover financial opportunities. Candidates in the CMT program gain free access to these powerful tools during the course of their study. Learn more at optima.com.
Hello and welcome to episode 34 of Fill the Gap, the official podcast of the CMT Association. My name is Tyler Wood. I am a chartered market technician, and with me, as always, is David Lundgren, CFA CMT. How are you doing, my friend?
My mood has improved as the day has gone on, because hopefully we've gotten, in the words of infamous William O'Neill, hopefully we've gotten a follow through day today. Big update in the markets, which we discussed with our guests today, and we'll see what happens, but it's good to see you as always.
It's great to see you. It's here on November 2nd, 2023. Markets just closed about a half an hour ago. We spent the whole afternoon trading session just picking the brain of one John Kolovos, current vice president of the board of directors for the CMT Association, also chief technical strategist at Macro Risk Advisors. Dave, highlights, and there are so many. What stands out from that hilarious, insightful, informative discussion we just had?
I think if I just kind of reflect on all the things we talked about, what I really loved about it was when he took the time to walk through his genealogy in the technical industry, you know, who he considers to be like his grandfather. Now, you know, the title he uses is grandfather. And so Jeff DeGraff is his grandfather. And I'm not sure how kindly Jeff will take to that. But his point being is that Jeff, you know, brought him into the business and hired him as his first, role as a technician, and then everybody in the business. I mean, for the most part, certainly as it relates to the association, we can point all the way back to our great 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 grandfather being Bob Farrell, and all of his offspring that came out of Merrill Lynch, and from there that one seed planted at Merrill Lynch, Ralph Acampore and others, here we are. We can all reflect back on through our genealogy, we can all lead right back to that one spot, which I just think is really fascinating.
It is fascinating also to think about how much technical analysis was taught on the fly, on the desk, through, you know, learning by doing, in the sense that prior to the CMT program, there wasn't a single body of knowledge, a candidate process that you would go through to scaffold the understanding. You know, you learned by working with people who had been in the markets for a long time. Incredible learning experience. And certainly for all of our listeners, I hope you have great mentors. And if you don't, you need to hook up with a community full of good mentors. But that genealogy for sure speaks to the decades of this professionalism and the responsible practice of technical analysis really being taught by hand, you know, in rote fashion, right?
Yeah.
Through mentorship.
Yeah.
The piece to me, Dave, that really stuck out, and I was reminded of a comment Brian Shannon made at a recent conference. He said, "Look, your clients pay you to manage risk better than the market." and that they're not paying you to just hold the index. They're not paying you to to sit there, but to actually take risk for them responsibly. And so when we're talking through the John's stock selection process, but also his kind of scenario planning or top down view, it really makes no difference where the S&P 500 goes. And we had a great update today in the markets, closing around 4,300. But that's not what portfolio management is about. And that regardless of whether we chop around sideways in this purgatory, or if we have a real rollover at the index level, the individual stock performance is what clients are paying you for, and how you construct that portfolio and how you manage that risk. And I thought that scenario in the late 90s of how do you talk to client PMs about participating in a very narrow and concentrated market that is an undeniable rally, and there's a lot of alpha to be captured, and it sort of feels like the clients are paying you to devise the most horrifying roller coaster ever, but keep them safe, right?
Yeah.
that's the job of the technical analyst, is to responsibly manage that risk when indeed those trends come to an end. And right. John has an incredible history, lots of great firms and great people that he has worked with, and certainly he's refined his tools and process very, very well over that time period. So without any further delay, I invite all of our listeners to sit back and relax and enjoy this conversation with John Kolovos, CMT CFA.
Welcome to episode 34 of Fill the Gap, the official podcast of the CMT Association. My name is Dave Lundgren, and for this episode, my co-pilot, Tyler Wood, and I are joined by John Kolovos. John is a CMT and CFA charter holder, and he's currently the chief market technician at Macro Risk Advisors, also known in the industry as MRA. John is a bigwig on the board of the CMT Association, where he serves as vice president. Thank you, John. And somehow we find time to also teach technical analysis over at Brandeis University. As we'll discuss, he's worked at several storied companies ranging from Lehman to Fidelity. And just as important, though, John is an avid guitarist. He's an avid Star Wars fan. And like the rest of us, he enjoys chasing a golf ball around in the woods. John Kolovos, welcome to Fill the Gap.
Thank you, Dave. Pleasure to be here.
That's even better than walkout music, Dave. That was an awesome intro. John, look at you blush. That's fantastic.
I am. You guys can see me. I'm laughing. Thank you very much, Dave. It was a very kind
nothing
intro.
But the best for the best. So, so in all seriousness, welcome to the podcast. Been really looking forward to this conversation. Getting you on. I mean, you've got so much experience to share with the community, all the different places you've worked, clients you've worked with, etc. So before we jump into your process and maybe a little bit of your outlook on the markets based on that process, maybe spend a little bit of time and let our listeners know a little bit about your background, what got you into the business, and most importantly, what got you along the technical path.
Sure. Yeah. And again, thanks for having me. Hopefully the listeners will get something out of this today, maybe a little bit of a stream of consciousness. But let me tell you, I got into markets at an incredibly young age. I would say maybe anywhere between 10 years old, 11. And I'm in my mid-40s at this point. I've been always fascinated and curious about the economy, about the stock market. And it really came about with my father. My father being an entrepreneur, has owned multiple restaurants over the course of his career. Good Greek that he is. Of course, he had to have restaurants. And I do remember I was basically raised in a restaurant, spending countless hours there alongside businessmen who were there for their martini lunches, essentially in the 80s, watching FNN and CNBC. And they would pull me to the side and be like, hey, kid, pat me on the head and be like, this is how you make money, in the market. And these are people who were showing up in Jaguars and Ferraris and whatnot. So I was always curious about it from that end of it. But I was also curious about it because my father would always tell me, he goes like, son, your day job will pay the bills, basically. But it's through investing will you be able to, accumulate wealth, essentially, and allow you to, save, to go on nice vacations. He eventually was able to put us through college and all of that. But I do remember one thing that really stuck in my head, and it was during the first Gulf War. And I was just barely, I think, like 11 or 12 at that time. And I remember how when Iraq invaded Kuwait, he got on the phone right away to his broker and he was trying to find out what was going on. And he was explaining to me how this spike in oil is bad for the economy. And he was really worried about it because an oil shock would do tremendous damage to a local business, like a restaurant, like my father's. And it sure did happen. Right. I remember that Christmas where like I had like one or two presents underneath the tree, whereas the year before, well, I was full. I mean, that's what an entrepreneur is. There's either feast or famine. And from that young age, I was like, wow, like the economy and the markets are linked and it has a direct impact on me and can have an impact on me.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of how I got into the markets themselves at a young age. I got bought my first stock in 1988. I believe it was Nintendo. Definitely was Nintendo. And it was based off the fact that I was really into Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. And it was kind of like my dad's way of doing like a Peter Lynch sort of thing.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Just
own what you know.
Yeah. Own what you know. And I got that. And that's when I kind of first got the bug on buying stocks. Later on, I would say down the road, I would watch Louis Rukeyser's show with him and then watch Benny Hill afterwards because it was PBS, right? So that was always fun. It was really my way of, so I can watch Benny Hill with him. But that was a lot of fun. And what I remember from those shows, and I think this maybe got me into the technicals a little bit, hearing about the Elves Index. And I was like, who are these guys? These guys sound really cool. So I think that may have been my first introduction to technicals. But I'll tell you something. This stuff is, I don't want to sound arrogant, but a little bit cocky, but it's relatively easy for me. Because when I got to high school, I wasn't a great student, by the way. I had long hair, wanted to be in a rock band and all that sort of stuff. But when I took my economics class senior year, it was like the only A that I got. And half the class failed. And I was like, wow. Like, I get this. Like, it was like a blink. Like, I understand markets. I understand the economy. So once I got to college, I cut my hair and I got my first internship by literally handing out a resume. I'm putting this in quotes, right? A resume. Remember those hard stock paper you would always have to put your resume on, right? I was literally at the corner of Broad and Wall, handing out a piece of paper with my name on it and the fact that I sold Cutco knives for one summer or something, right? And this one person was so impressed that I was doing that. I wound up getting like an internship at a small trading shop. And that was my summer into sophomore year for university. So that was how I kind of got my first step kind of professionally into the markets. But guess what? Just like most shops at that time, it blew up even before I had a chance to even start. So I put my tail between my legs. I called my cousin who worked at Lehman at the time, and it was an operations gig. And he's like, come work with me. Not a problem at all, John. You know, you need beer money for school and all that. So I was like, okay. Within like a day, I'm like, I'm not doing operations. I can't do it. That was on the fifth floor of the Lehman Brothers headquarters. The sixth floor was the trading desk. And I would go upstairs all the time, meeting people, seeing what was going on. This was back then when the trading desks were real. Right. Like it was noisy and people running around like maniacs and screaming and basically got to know people. And the summer of 97, I was hired as like an unofficial intern, essentially, to work with Steve Weiss. So Steve Weiss, I'm sure many of your listeners know and you guys know, you know, he's pretty big on CNBC these days on Halftime and all that. He really gave me my first shot at working on Wall Street, so to speak. And he was transitioning from another job. And I spent that entire summer stuffing envelopes, doing red herrings, going on the first call terminal, doing all those sort of things, taking orders, breakfast orders, egg and cheese sandwich orders, you know, left and right. I mean, that's a whole nother story. I would do that. And as a slight tangent, I remember I screwed up a breakfast order once. And I remember one guy leaning into me so bad saying, if you can't take a breakfast order right, how are you going to take a stock order right? And then from that point forward, I've been like a stickler about getting orders the right way and paying a lot of attention to detail. So anyways, I'm getting to how I got into the technicals. Made a lot of good connections that summer, was asked to come back for the summer of 98. And this is when the defining moment happened. It was during Long Term Capital.
Yeah.
The markets were unraveling. And at that time, I probably thought I was going to be like a fundamental analyst or sales trader or something along those lines, right? And when the markets were collapsing at that time, they would have analyst after analyst after analyst go on top of this, go to a podium, essentially, almost like you're at church and they're standing on top of this podium, talking to the entire trading desk, trying to explain what the heck is going on. And you had this analyst going up making, I'm telling you, big bucks, like rock star analyst going up there saying, I don't know what the bleep is going on. And sure enough, Steve Shobin goes up there, who was their chief technician at the time, and was just like, hey, this is how markets behave. Sometimes they crash. And he kind of walked through level-headedly, just being like, there's going to be a sentiment at extreme. We're going to look for like pull call rate. I remember going through the different indicators he's going to look at to say that we're going to have a washout. And then guess what? We'll likely do a retest. We'll create some sort of bottom, double bottom of sorts. And then we should recover afterwards, right? I was like, wow. So that's when I initially learned that there was a disconnect, if you will, between like the fundamentals, what I've been being taught at school ad nauseum, versus what the market was telling us. And he was so crystal clear in how he explained it that I had to go into his office and I was shaking in my boots. I knocked on his door. I'm like, hey, hi, I'm John. And he's like, John, please come in. Like, he couldn't have been the sweetest man in the world. And the rest was history. He literally took me under his wing at a very young age. I was still in college, undergrad. And he basically told me what books to get. He advised me to literally draw. If you want to get a feel of the markets, John, do your charts by hand. And at that time, I didn't have to. This was in the 90s, but it's like, do it. So he's like, do the Dow 30 by hand. And I did. And I did the Dow 30 by hand. And then finally, the summer of 99, when I was graduating, I got hired to work on the sales desk. Yay. I really wanted to work with Steve, but you'll see how I got there. I show up and I go, hey, Steve, I did the Dow 30. And I had 30 stocks and I charted all 30 stocks. And he goes, what? I just wanted you to do the index. I was like, oh, man. So I did that. And then eventually, I wound up meeting Jeff DeGraff at that time. I remember the day I met Jeff, actually. And Steve looked at me, goes, I have a feeling you two are going to work together. And I'm like, oh, okay, that sounds great. And then Jeff had just started in 1998 at Lehman Brothers. But Steve retired, and I think Jeff pretty much hired me because I wouldn't leave him alone. Like, I would be like, hey, can I help you? Can I help you? I was working on a sales desk doing spreadsheets. I was already calling, I think it was Market Vane that did at the time, that you actually had to call a number. It was a pre-recorded number, and they would give you and I would sit there and put those down writing by hand, or every Monday go on Barron's and literally just type out all the data that was in the market lab into a spreadsheet. And I was doing that even before I joined the team. So I think probably Jeff's sanity more than anything else. He's like, fine, you can work for me. So that's how I got into the markets and how I got into charts.
And at the time, Jeff was the head of technicals at Lehman?
Yes. Yeah, so when Steve retired, Jeff took over. Yeah. And Jeff before that was doing the international product for a little bit. But he eventually took over. I believe it was in 1998 he took over, or 1999.
For those that haven't listened already, I don't know, Tyler, maybe you can confirm for us, but we had Jeff on as a guest, I think in the first year. It was a fantastic episode. Mm-hmm. He's a great guy. Great. He's one of the best technicians on the street. So it's definitely worth a listen again.
So, John, you have worked for so many different firms on the street, but you've also worked with some of the greatest technicians of our generation and those prior. Talk to us a little bit about the genealogy of where you've been and who you've learned from along the way.
Sure. So it's funny you ask. So I remember when I introduced J.C. O'Hara to Jeff DeGraff. See, J.C. O'Hara was one of my junior analysts when I was working at a company called Concept Capital and eventually MF Global. And when I introduced JC to Jeff, I said, hey, JC, this is your grandfather in technical analysis. And both JC and Jeff were just like, what are you talking about? Like, you're completely insane. And I explained to them, like, there's a whole genealogy of where we all come from, right? So JC is related to Jeff through me, essentially through the technicals. Now Jeff got his start really through Steve Shobin, right? And Steve Shobin picked up Jeff because John Roque had left to go do his own thing, Okay. Mm-hmm. So in some form, I kind of relate as a stepbrother-ish or some step-sibling-ish to John Roque, right? But Steve Shobin got the Lehman Brothers job because Phil Roth left Lehman Brothers. But all of them, Steve and Phil, where did they come from? They came from Merrill Lynch, okay? And from there, who else am I related to?
Robert Farrell.
Frank Teixeira, right? Bob Prechter, Steve Nissen, you know, Candlestick guy, right? Walter Murphy, Art Crawford of all people, right? Walter Diemer, right? He was there for a little while. George Constantine, right? And Dave, even to a certain extent, we're related through technicals through your working with Frank, right? And I'm also related to Guy and on all that.
Yeah.
But ultimately, at the end of the day, it goes to Dick McCabe, right? Like, we all come from Dick McCabe, but I think the number one is Bob Farrell, right? I think Bob Farrell has tons of great, great, great grandchildren and technicals. And when at the 50th Symposium, it was so awesome to see him there. It was like me seeing my Mick Jagger, right? Or my Eddie Van Halen. And I was like, oh my God. And man, it was so sweet. I was like, I got to take a picture with him. And then I grabbed Frank, right? Because Frank worked, you know, at Merrill. And then I saw Bob Prechter. I'm like, I got to get you guys all together in picture with me because we're all related in technicals. And Bob Farrell's sweet. He goes, oh, that's really nice. And Prechter looked at me like, you're the crazy one, right? So, and I did that. And it's true. I like talking to people and see where they came from in the business. Doesn't make it right or wrong. But what I've learned through that as I think about it is that you see people I named who worked at Merrill Lynch at the time. Yeah, you had some like Steve Shobin. He's all about big bases. I love big bases, right? Bob Farrell was about big bases. But Steve Nissen's all about candlesticks. I love candlesticks, right? I study them closely. Bob Prechter, right? Obviously into the Elliott Wave. I just started learning about Elliott Wave. I'm really curious about Elliott Wave. Arch Crawford about cycles and whatnot. That's like my next new passion. It's like I want to learn more about cycles and see what I can get out of all of that. So I think it's in my DNA to want to learn. If it was okay for them, why can't I learn a little bit about it? So I'm just really intrigued by that. And I would recommend anybody else too, like just to continue educating yourself on the technicals. You don't have to come from a weird genealogy like I came up with, but just keep learning. What's the saying we say at the CMT, standing on the shoulder of giants or something like that? Like
Absolutely.
Like I kind of do that. And again, it'd be hard for me to not mention Craig Peskin, who I worked with as well. I worked with Craig when I was at Lehman Brothers. And he worked with Bob Farrell directly, right before Bob retired. And I learned a lot off of Craig. He would tell me all these things about Bob. And it was just a tremendous learning experience to be around these people who are associated with these people. So I hope one day JC hires a junior who has a junior, and then I can be related to this individual and so on and so forth. So we can continue to pass on this wonderful knowledge base that we have, that we call,
I love it. Don't sell yourself short, Grandpa Kolovos. I mean, over there at Brandeis University, you're giving life to the next generation. So don't underestimate your impact, both as a professor, but also as vice president of the CMT Association. A lot of new minds being touched.
Yeah. So when did you get your CFA, and why did you get your CFA?
Why did I get my CFA? I got my CFA after I got my CMT. And why did I get it? I got it because I realized that one plus one equals three, and that there was a lot more to the markets than just squiggly lines. Because when I first started, I mean, when I got my first Bloomberg terminal, I mean, I put every indicator on that darn thing. I mean, every single one. And I thought it was the coolest thing. And it actually, it doesn't mean anything. Like right now, my charts is just price, a moving average, and maybe an RSI. That's basically it, right? Mm-hmm. So because I knew, and I was learning at the time, that technical things essentially happen for fundamental reasons, and I wanted to be prepared for that. But also the CFA program, what I found interesting for me wasn't the fundamental part. Like level two was tough. Like that was not for me. It was level three actually was fun. Can I say that? Like I actually liked taking level three because it was about portfolio management. So as a whole, yeah. I really liked what it was offering. It was, again, I'm super passionate about this stuff. I want to learn. I'm like, yeah, I'm a glutton for pain. Let's do this. Right. So that's why the CFA.
Yeah. And in your work today, I mean, do you lean on the CFA at all? I mean, I know you do a lot of intermarket analysis and things like that, but it's from my understanding is your approach is pretty much entirely technical, right?
Yeah, I kind of have to be because I don't want to double count what my clients are reading. So like, so to speak, like when I worked at Fidelity, right? Like I was only allowed to stay in my lane, do not talk about anything else besides the charts because I'm hired to be the expert on technical analysis. So I do stay in my lane as close as I can. I do the intermarket stuff, right? But I'm not like reading deeply into the economic reports or anything like that. It's more about the reaction to it.
Yeah, exactly.
But what I do rely on is there's a great content on behavioral finance that was very helpful for me. I do lean on that still. But the portfolio management end of it, and I learned this like almost on day one working Fidelity is like to be a stock picker is one thing, but to be a portfolio manager, completely different game. And 98% of my clients are not technicians. They are institutional portfolio managers. So what I learned during the curriculum kind of really got me into their mindset, so to speak. So now I know their language, so that way I can then give them the gospel of Charles Dow.
Yep, super important. That's I got my CFA when I was at Fidelity as well, and that's why I got it. You know, to be able to speak the language when I walk the floors with ideas technically, you know, to be able to at least understand what they were saying back to me. And plus, as you said, the passion for the business and passion for fundamentals and everything else. But at the end of the day, when you said double count, what I thought you were going to infer by that was that I don't want to double count my own opinion, because if I start using fundamentals, that's putting my opinion into the market twice, and we only need it once. And if you're going to take one opinion, it's better to be the markets than mine. So
for sure. I mean, we have our biases, don't we? Right. And even as technicians, we can have them. So it's incredibly imperative for everybody, definitely us, to kind of put them to the side. And I still cringe to this day when I see folks, particularly on the Mac, and I work at a macro shop, but like a lot of macro analysts, they're just always bearish, you know? So I think it's really dangerous to kind of like already kind of have a bearish tilt to things. And then you start looking at charts and you just kind of extrapolate like, oh, look, it's a death cross and the macro's this, then therefore we're going into a depression. No, you kind of just want to stay in your lane and be as objective as possible.
What do you think the reason is for that? Why are most macro strategists bearish? Why is that?
I you know why? Because these folks are so smart. They are so smart that I think they know that this doesn't make sense. The markets just really just don't make academic sense. It doesn't. So I think you need to be like a little blissfully ignorant to be in this business, right? You want to know enough, but you don't want to know too much. Because I think what happens is that these folks become a little bit too overconfident, if you will, in their ability to forecast or they have their overconfidence that I spent all this time studying this. I got a PhD in that. Therefore, I know how to do this. No, I think you need to kind of like let them listen to the markets as well. Right? Don't force your opinion into the markets. I think these folks are actually they're brilliant people. I wish I had their brains, to be quite honest with you. But I think that's what it is. They just... look at this doesn't make sense. And it's kind of true. Like the macro environment for the last 15 years with quantitative easing and negative interest rates.
Yeah.
Huh? Like that's bizarre. Mm-hmm. So I understand their frustration. I totally do. But I think they also just want to be right and they don't want to make money. So if you want to borrow Ned Davis's quote, right? You know, be right or make money kind of thing. I think they would rather be right. I think people look at us to help them make the money.
Yep.
So is that like enjoying a meal at McDonald's? Like if you actually knew what went into the sandwich, you couldn't actually enjoy your meal. Is it that these trends are so unsustainable that we're all just waiting for the heart attack to come our way? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I guess so. The McDonald's analogy is pretty funny because you can tie that into a lot of different things, Tyler. You can think about like, what's the health of the market? The health of the market could be, you can see somebody or a market that's in an uptrend, but the health of the market is really determined by its breadth and et cetera, right? So you know, like me, like I'm relatively healthy looking, but who knows if I'm a walking heart attack or not, right? That's why you go to the doctors, check your internals, right? So I think there's a little bit to that. And I think a lot of folks, and even the macro side of things, kind of miss that. Also, the data is incredibly lagged. My God, right? It's like why? But I get it. I mean, I'm on the sell side for most of my career. I was only on the buy side for like 5 or 6 years, but you need a narrative to sell things. So I get it. So I understand that part of it. And also to be intellectual about things, you do need to think every scenario out. So I'm not trying to dismiss the macro. I use it a lot. I'm not a macro shop. Last thing I'm going to do is say it's not any good, but you have to think. It helps you critically think. But from my process, it's the price action first. And if the macros tend to confirm, great. Where I think most users are the other way. I have my fundamental thesis. And then once the markets confirm, then I have conviction.
Yeah, we often don't know the why until much later. And I think the fragility of what we're seeing right now, it seems constant. But it also seemed constant in 2016, right? Brexit and Trump's election. And I mean, the Cubs winning the last game of the season. None of that made sense to anybody. And yet markets kept climbing higher. So do you explore with your clients what that catalyst might be under the hood? Or do you spend more time just reflecting to them what the current situation is?
Very good question. So at my current position at Macro Risk Advisors, I have many different types of clients, a big spectrum. I have hedge fund clients who may be only putting trades on for a couple days. And we're also very options heavy. Mm-hmm. So from a short-term perspective, I got to be aware of what those catalysts are and how the market may respond to said catalyst. And what the setup is going into said catalyst, right? If this is market extended in one direction or another, is it a good risk reward going into that catalyst? Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm fully aware of it. But again, my other end of the spectrum of my clients are long onlys. A good chunk of my clients are long onlys. And then they're not day trading, right? Mm-hmm. For them, it's more about, okay, what was the reaction to the Fed? What was the follow through post payrolls, right? Those sort of things. So I, unfortunately, my head is spinning in my current role where, I do have to pay attention to the short-term wiggles because I have trading accounts, but then again, my long onlys, not so much. It's more about, tell me when I'm going to be really, really wrong.
Yeah. Fascinating observation that you can use the same exact technical toolkit on all of those timeframes, serving clients who are holding for 2 days and those who are holding for 2 years.
Yeah, but don't tell people it's that easy, okay? Because but it's so true, right? What is it? It's the fractal nature of markets, right? That's exactly what that is. You know, trend is a trend is a trend is a trend. Doesn't matter if it's a 1 minute chart or a 1 year chart.
And that's across asset classes, and it's all across geographies and public and private. You know, it's all the same thing. It's all trends reflecting fundamentals. You know,
So let's talk a little bit about your toolkit. You mentioned on your charts, you've got price, maybe some trend lines, a moving average. Why so simple?
I think it goes back to your previous question. Do you really want to know what's going in there? really, really, really want to know.
Just see the golden arches. I'm just happy to be
here. Yeah. I think I learned that and I still struggle with it. There's a lot up here in our heads, and we want to convey it to clients. But do they really need to know that? Yeah, behind the scenes, I have probably like 3 or 4 models that are driving the output of what they're looking at. Am I really paying that much of attention to the 200-day moving average? And I try to keep it simple so I can just be able to communicate my views to them. But at the same time, isn't that what it's about, right? Like, we don't want to overthink things. So basically, if you just ask me what I look on a basic chart when I publish stuff, it's very clean. I know Dave used to see it, right? It's like priced S&P chart is S&P as it is, 50, 200-day moving average and an RSI, maybe an MACD here and there, right? But that's basically it. What goes on behind, right, are trend models, breadth models, sentiment models, right? Multi-composite models, essentially. A lot of gook going into that sausage. Cycle work, Elliott wave work, the mark, you name it, it's all in there. But do they need to see that? And a big part of my process, I consider myself like a techno quant. Like I adhere to the traditional technical analysis rules, if you will, like very much Charles Dow and all that, mm-hmm. but being systematic about it, being able to have a repeatable process about it, have mm-hmm. Your indicators, they back tested, dispelling myths and all that, mm-hmm. have that ready to go, have selection tools, because it's not a guessing game, it's a probability game, right? And you want to be mm-hmm. able to convey that to your readers. So I do keep it simple for the reader, and I think that's important, but there's a lot of work. There's a technical mosaic, if you will, going on behind the scenes.
And it's mostly like, I know you said quant, but it's like systematic analysis versus all those things that you just mentioned and doing all of that analysis subjectively, right? You actually have built models yes. to assess all these different things.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's totally right. And you can even throw in factor work as well. It's probably the closest yeah. fundamentals that I'll do is to study the trends of the various factors, right? Because at the end of the day, we want to fish in the pond where the fish are, kind of thing, right? So mm-hmm. that's probably the extent of my fundamental work. What I'll be looking for cheap is when, you know, values outperforming growth or something along those lines. And I'll dig deeper into the different value factors and say, okay, well, let's hone in on those. If I just may just kind of just bring it back a little bit in terms of process and my history, and a hat tip to Jeff, I will tell you, when I started working with him and officially in 99, he said, look, listen, we need to dispel myths and technicals. He wanted to get rid of the purple crayon, so to speak, of people just drawing head and shoulders on charts and double bottoms and stuff. He's like, we need to quantify what we're doing. We need to put numbers behind what we're doing. And I think he was quite early on that. I know Ned was doing a lot of that at that time too, but I think Jeff might've been one of the first bulge bracket guys that was doing that. Like, we built tremendous databases at that time. You know, I think everybody has them now, like percentage of stocks above moving averages and new highs and new lows and correlations and stuff like the bottom up databases. But we were doing that in 99 and in 2000 on the entire GIX universe, right? And taking it back in time. So big part of my process from early on was to quantify what we're doing. Don't take my word for it is basically what he was going for. Yeah. And still to this day, he's had a tremendous run doing that. Like, he's probably more data scientist than anything else at this point, but yeah, hat tip to him for doing that. And it was huge for me for being able to work with him and to learn that from him and then to carry yeah. that on in my work today.
Yeah, that's great. Do you know, I saw this chart the other day of, it was the enterprise value, I think it was, of the Magnificent Seven, which is the seven largest companies that have kind of driven the S&P higher this year. And it was basically the enterprise value of those seven stocks divided by GDP. Okay. And over the past, I don't know, I can't remember how long it was, but it's probably 5 years or so, there's this massive head and shoulders top. And this macro strategist was pointing out this massive head and shoulders top on the enterprise value of these Magnificent Seven relative to GDP. So, you know, so the question obviously is, you know, do you think you can do technical analysis on fundamental data like that? Or do you think that's another example of technical analysis improperly used?
Sorry, Dave. Yeah, there's a few things that come to mind the second you say that. One is stay in your lane, right? So I always get nervous when macro folks or non-technicians are leaning on technicals to make their call, right? It's like, this time of year, it is the season for seasonality, right? Like, everybody's an expert in seasonality at the end of the year, right? Everybody knows that. And you just kind of like, if you go through your entire list of reasons to be bullish and you can't find any except for seasonality, it's like, ugh, it's kind of cringy, right? So that's number one. But can you do technical analysis on fundamentals? Well, how about this? If it trends, and you have a systematic or objective way to measure trends, and you notice a trend change in that data series, why not? Why not? Maybe it doesn't fit the criteria of it having proper behavioral reasons for why it's moving, right? But Dave, you taught this at Brandeis, the checklist of trend change approach, right? You follow many, many steps to identify a trend change. If there's an economic data point that has that, sure, why not? Mm-hmm. Sure, why not? I just get a little nervous with this guy or gal, whoever, it doesn't matter. is saying head and shoulders on an economic data. I'm like, oh, maybe stay in your lane. Because you know what the best pattern is? Failed head and shoulders.
Yeah.
Failed head and shoulders is the best pattern. So we'll see if that happens on that.
Right.
This is a debate that gets my back up all the time, because the when you go back and read Edwards and McGee, what they're talking about in price patterns is visualizing behavior in markets, right? Yeah. So if we've got consolidation and then resuming an uptrend, forget what, you know, flags or pennants, whatever pattern we're talking about, what they were looking at was a way of seeing how markets were digesting investor behavior. And all they're pointing out is, look, buyers are back in control. And what we see, you know, shorts get covered, everybody moves to the same side of the ship. We can all conclude that now the trend has resumed and everybody piles into that side of the trade, adding velocity to the move. That doesn't, that behavioral element doesn't happen on macroeconomic data. Seeing trends in any data set, that makes sense. And that trends might persist in a direction certainly makes sense. But I think that the super low barrier to entry for people calling themselves a technical analyst today is, I mean, it's scary, right? 2021, how many TikTok traders came onto my Instagram reels saying, bro, just buy when the line goes up and just BTFD every time it dips, you know, just pile more money in there because it only goes up. Like, it's super irresponsible.
Yeah.
And I think there's, I mean, to your point, John, 25 years ago, you and Jeff and other really responsible technicians were putting evidence behind what you were observing, quantifying the way that the tools work and the probabilities with which they'll continue to work. I mean, there's so much more to it. And I think that, you know, God bless charting packages that are out there, because everybody has access to the same price data and a lot of these really powerful tools. But man, it doesn't take a whole lot for somebody to spot a head and shoulders top. And most of the time, they're not waiting for it to break the neckline on the right shoulder and see that it's actually followed through. So
down,
there's my diatribe.
Yeah. You break it down, then you have your throwback to resist. There's a whole way that it goes. But Jeff said, and I agree, and I say this to folks, you got to get rid of that purple crayon, right?
Yeah.
Can't just be squiggling on stuff and seeing what you think you see. Because if I stare at a cloud long enough, I'll see turtles and elephants. I'm sure if you stare at a piece of graph paper long enough, you're going to see something, right? Yeah. But even still, like I'm not trying to dismiss patterns. It's part of the mosaic. Don't get me wrong. It's part of the mosaic. But there are rules that go with applying those patterns, right? There's ways they break down. There's ways that they behave. There's measured moves off of them, all that sort of stuff.
Right.
How much you want to weave that into your thought process, that's up to you, right? But even those have steps involved. It's not complete guesswork. And I think a lot of people lose that when it comes to what we do. They just think we're almost guessing it. But behind me, I know this is a podcast and we could see it. I have a book of almost like a library of technical analysis books behind me, right? There's a huge body of knowledge that predates all of us. So anyway.
Well, the idea is that that body of knowledge is essential for a base understanding of what markets are about, what technical analysis is, how to use it properly and all that. And without that base understanding and base knowledge, you can't systematically do anything. If you start doing things systematically and feel good about that because you're being scientific and systematic, but you actually don't know what you're doing, that's not helpful at all. You need to know what you're doing first before you start building models around that knowledge or lack of knowledge, right?
Such a good point. Everybody can code in Python, but everybody needs to go back and listen to John Bollinger's episode about understanding the first principle.
Yeah, well said.
So true. And I don't know where you want to go with this, but I want to tell you one thing, though. What first came to mind was you were saying, and I struggle with this today still with new traders and just even seasoned vets. It's context is key. It's one thing to be oversold. It's one thing, like the marks are very, very popular now. It's one thing to have like a 13-9 combo going on. But where is that happening, right? Is this happening at an area of support? Is it happening still in an uptrend, right? Like context is key. And I think a lot of these quant models, they just kind of bucket stuff, but they don't take into consideration how it got there, the speed in which it got there. And what I always say, my favorite model, my favorite multi-factor model, honey, has two variables. It's my left eye and my right eye. Right, you need to overlay that in your work, right? So you can spit out, and I have multi-factor models, but I still have to run it through the last model, which is my left eye and my right eye.
Yeah, that's such a good answer, John. I think I threw Ari Wald a curveball and I said, hey, with all of this quantitative evidence, why do you need the chart? And you just said it, right? The context is key.
Yeah. So let's do a quick overview of your process. Like, what are the things that you look at from a day-to-day perspective? And then from there, we can transition into, you know, based on that being your process, what are you seeing today? See if you can help us sort of navigate the window of time we're in here.
Okay, you got it. So what I'll try and do is, and cut me off because there's a lot going on up here. what I will try and say is this: I try to marry top down and bottom up technical work together, right?
Yeah.
And there's a few things in my philosophy that I really, really believe in. And I think maybe first we'll just talk about how I call the markets. And then I think a separate conversation will be, how do I pick stocks? Because I think they're completely two different processes altogether. They're related, they overlap. There's a Venn diagram where they overlap, but I think they need to be separate. So when it comes to like the day-to-day and the market stuff, yeah, from a top-down perspective, we're looking at trend, right? I have trend models, what's the primary trend of the market, et cetera, et cetera. That's number one. You determine what the trend is. I have a multi-factor model. What does it do? What does it capture? It captures moving average crossover, slopes of moving averages, you name it. There's about six different variables in there. Number one, I want to know what the trend is. Number two, the next step in my whole process is like, where is momentum, right? Because you can have positive and negative in a downtrend and vice versa. So I have different types of momentum. What momentum is there? There's price momentum and there's breadth momentum. And there's two different things, right? Percentage of stocks above a moving average is the momentum of breadth. That's how I categorize that. Yeah. Whereas the advanced decline line is the trend of breadth. So I have to study those to help me confirm what I see on the index level, right? So I have trend on the index. Then I look up momentum, whether it be price-based or bottom-up based. Then, of course, I look at sentiment. And again, what people say and what people are doing. You have your surveys, AII, blah, 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 all that. And then I look at what people are actually doing through the options market, pull-call ratios, the VIX curve, flow data, et cetera, right? Now you keep going down a little bit further. The macro, I lean on the macro quite a bit, call it intermarket analysis, call it cross asset research, right? Your technicians got that stolen from them. It's really intermarket, but you do that. And from there, I lean on it a lot because it's probably the closest to the fundamentals I'll get to my market call, right? Because macro is a form of fundamental analysis, right? So when I study the trends of interest rates or gold or oil, you name it, that's important, right? The direction's important. But the second part of that is, what is the volatility of those moves within the macro, right? What is the level of macro uncertainty that is out there? And that's hugely important right now, because when macro uncertainty is low and starts to rise, it increases the probability of a left tail event, okay? So like for a while now, for about a good year or so, yeah, rates have been going the wrong way, gold's been going the wrong way, but it's been relatively orderly. As of late, the volatility of those moves have picked up. And people going, oh boy, you know, go, what's going on? They're waiting for that mistake. It doesn't mean it's going to happen, but the odds of the mistake have increased. So as the S&P now is starting to break trend a little bit, you got to be careful on the index level that something's happening. Mind you, most stocks already are a disaster, right? Like already a disaster, like a complete disaster. At the symposium, I gave a little spiel, and I remember the whole room was like trying to be all bullish about the bull market. And I'm like, can you pull up a chart at the Russell 3 advanced decline line? Mm-hmm. And it was like a hum, a silence across the room, because it was at a new low. And people were like, what's going on? And I'm like, well, because the market's broken, mm-hmm. right? There's something wrong here. So that's that. So that's kind of like my top down. Then I go ahead and do almost the same exercise on the sectors. And you kind of go down all the way down to, that's essentially it. So it's my market stuff. So
when you do that, do you have a bunch of inputs that you systematically follow, and it's probably the same models week to week. Do you have a summary indicator that says, you know, these are the 15 or 20 relationships that I monitor? Of these 15 or 20 relationships, five of them are positive, you know, 12 of them are neutral, and the rest are negative. Do you do that as a composite?
Yes, I do that as a composite. But what it is, Dave, is it kind of sets more of a conditional backdrop to how the environment is, right? It kind of tells you, like,
you context. Context.
And you and I have told me, we can talk, lead us into portfolio and stock selection. It kind of leads you into a little bit about what your exposure may be on a portfolio level, right? If all this isn't so hot, why am I fully invested in the market, or vice versa? If the markets are giving me signals, but even though the economics isn't saying it's so good, maybe I should have more exposure. It sets the tone more than it does necessarily the call, right? There could be other elements involved there.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. And so systematic, bottom up, top down, similar, you know, you and I talk about this a lot, and, you know, your writing style is very similar to mine. Your research process is similar to mine. So a backhanded compliment to me is that you're awesome. So when we go through that process though, what do you find today, and how do you convey? I mean, I know the answer because it's extremely mixed and it's very disconnected. You talked about your comments, which I remember at the symposium when you talked about how everybody's bullish, but the average stock is kind of falling apart. So there's that observation that can be made, but then how do you translate that into an action plan for a portfolio manager who has to try to beat a benchmark that's going up because of seven stocks?
Sure. So that's a fantastic question. So I think with this current environment, right? First, you have to educate everybody to a certain extent. What does breadth really mean? So you go through that whole process. And it's not just the RSP. I'm glad the RSP was invented. I wish a technician invented the RSP because it's really an ETF for breadth, right? But I'm glad that it's there. So what I try to do is I try to give them historical examples of when we've had negative breadth divergences. We have to give them context again, right? So the most recent kind of ish example of such a negative breadth divergence was, of course, the 1999. It's very similar-ish to what happened in the 90s. Some would even say that we've never seen it this bad. Okay, that's possible, right? But you also can look in the 70s when breadth was pretty darn bad, and in the 40s, breadth was pretty darn bad. And what I found is, just like economic data, that breadth can have a long and variable lag. Right? It could take a long time for it to resolve, and it often resolves poorly, bad, right? So in the 90s, yeah, everyone was right for saying that breadth was bad. But from the low at the long-term capital in 98 to the peak in March of 2000, the S&P went up like 60-ish%. Like you had to be careful in terms of how bearish you were going to be at that time. But since most stocks were going down at that moment, right, your portfolio construction was a little bit different. One, you needed to be involved in those that were working. You had to be. You can't just fold your arms and say, oh, I'm not doing this because breadth is bad. No, you needed to own those. You needed to own them in size, okay? So your exposure levels are there. You're maybe not as fully invested because most stocks are going down, but you still needed to be in those names. So like right now, you needed to be in the Magnificent Seven. The other end of it is that you have to tell your clients that now, since your portfolio is concentrated, you've now increased idiosyncratic risk to your portfolio. So now any of those one Magnificent Sevens have to crush earnings, have to do everything right. Otherwise, it will go down and the index will go down and then scare the bejesus everybody even more so, right? So it kind of leads into your portfolio construction, but also be mindful of what the risks are, and that increases idiosyncratic risk. So hopefully that kind of answers that question, like how do you convey those sort of things? So it's history, lean into what is working, of course, but with that comes risks. So the next part of the breadth argument is like, I wouldn't be surprised next year that this resolves in a down S&P and an up RSP and IWM. Mm. I wouldn't be surprised to see that, because that's how it resolved in 99, essentially, where the mega caps caught down and everybody else was done with their bear and they went up. I wouldn't be surprised to see that. And I don't know if folks are really prepared for that, because we think kind of binary, all up, all down.
Yeah,
that one would be one scenario that I think maybe we do need to pay attention to. So we get a bear market on the index level, but we get a stealth bull underneath. That's a possibility. I think that's one thing we need to consider.
Yeah. I wonder, you know, the whole comparison to 99, I completely understand that. And, you know, like you managed through it at the time. And so I know exactly what it felt like. This feels a lot like it. But there's a lot of things that also are very different from 99 in the sense that you could make the case that the whole 99 blow off bubble thing happened in 21. That's already done. It's already over. It's already imploded. ARK went down 80%. And, you know, that whole bubble and unwind has already happened. And so now from that perspective, we're kind of in a weird, you know, post-bubble environment that where most stocks are still suffering the overhang of that bubble unwind. And the these mega cap names, you know, I refer to them as toothpaste tech because they have these recurring revenue streams just like toothpaste. And so they one of the reasons they've done so well is because today portfolio managers flock to Microsoft just as they used to flock to Procter & Gamble 10, 20 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. So then I wonder, because everything is similar but different, so it's different enough that you have to obviously be open-minded, as you always have to be. But I think we may have talked about this, but what do you think about comparing today's environment to 94, where we had a horrific bear market in bonds? Breadth got absolutely annihilated. There was arguably, it was probably the worst bear market, like real bear market, since the 70s, in, you know, underneath the surface in 94. And the S&P never went down more than 10%. And that divergence resolved upward into what became the bubble of 99. What do you see any of that evidence?
I do see any of that. I think that this would be the bullish way out of things, right? It would be this scenario. That was at that time the fastest or the second fastest Fed hiking cycle to date at that time, right? So they were really slowing things down. And after the market broke out a little bit, they started realizing, oh, my God, I think we're going to run into a recession. So they actually preemptively cut rates. And I think early 95, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't have the chart in front of me. They preemptively cut rates. And that is kind of the hope, I think, here right now that folks are seeing in the market, that they're going, they just signaled that they want to stop. Right. I think that's why the markets are rallying right now. We're in early November. Markets are starting a nice little rally here. Could be seasonal. Could just be deep oversold. But the narrative, at least for the last day or so, has been, oh, they're done. OK, now the hope is they're going to start cutting now. So they're going to cut for one of two reasons. One, they preemptively see the recession. Let's get ahead of this. Right. And my unprofessional opinion is they should, because what we see with negative breadth are banking stocks are ready to go out of business. They need to knock it off and start cutting rates and be preemptive. But doesn't that sound like they're trend followers too? They're going to follow the data. So I kind of think like they're going to follow the Dow. So until the Dow goes down 20%, they're probably not going to cut rates. So that also puts us in that scenario of what they usually do is they cut rates to stem a recession and stem a bear market. But that's the analog, Dave, that I'm thinking of. I think that's the way out of this, the positive resolution out of this, is they start cutting preemptively to stem some sort of macro mistake, i.e. a banking crisis.
You know, it's just the idea that you just said that the Fed may be like triggering off of the market, which, you know, actually, if they actually did do that, I'd say good for them, because that's not a bad thing to trigger off of. But herein lies the conundrum on that, because we just had this extensive discussion about how the S&P is saying one thing, and that's probably what they're keying off of, or the Dow or whatever. But the reality is the average stock in the market is, prior to today anyway, is 29% below its bull market peak, 29%. So the bear market that the Fed might otherwise signal off of to say, okay, we got to ease off on this tightening, is already underway, and it's been going for almost 2 years now. And so they've actually maybe missing the boat in the sense that the bear market that they're trying to cause in equities has been going on for 2 years, and they just don't see it because they're focusing on the Dow and whatnot.
Yeah, so, I think we need to send in breadth indicators. That's what we need to do.
So we'll make sure to include in the show notes for all of our listeners. I just pulled up the Value Line Geometric Index. I know you love to look at it, Dave. John, you referenced the RSP, but it's screaming off the chart at me that we're right at what has been support and resistance, right? The polarity concept all through 2019, lots of support right here at this 500, 520 level. And to your point, Dave, Value Line is down from 700 to 500 since that peak in the summer of 21. To your scenario planning, John, right? The stealth rally underneath the hood, even if the top line large cap indices continue to crater from here, then we could see a stealth bull market in the average stock pulling up from what is a really clear support level. It was support back in October of 22 as well. John, when you do all of this scenario planning, I'm often told that markets move in three directions, right? Up, down, or sideways. Mm-hmm. Is there a scenario where, as Dave pointed out, like we're in this post-bubble collapse, but not not really a, you know, bear market so much anymore. It's super indecisive. What if this purgatory continues? Could it continue? Yeah.
I think that's another one. I think it's another important scenario. And I think it's probably the most likely one, because my biggest worry is that we are heading into some sort of secular bear market of sorts on stocks, a maybe lost decade or half decade, if you will. I don't think it's necessarily going to be as bad as the last one. And the environment that I think of the most akin to it would be between 1946 and 1949. If you would pull up a chart of the Dow between that time frame, it went nowhere during that entire environment. The advanced decline line for the New York Stock Exchange was in a steady downtrend during that period. It didn't bottom to 1949. So I think we could be in a scenario like that. And I do, what bothers me besides the breadth is how strong commodities have been. So from a secular standpoint, when commodities are in a secular uptrend, which I think they are, we can debate that, but like oil going negative, that's like a low, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they don't overlap for very long periods of time. I'm talking secular trends. So when stocks are in a secular uptrend, commodities tend to be in a secular downtrend. So now we have this overlap going on, and we're going through a tantrum, I think, this transition between, all right, commodities are about to confirm their secular uptrend. Maybe it's oil at 120, right? And then maybe that finally unrattles markets, so on and so forth. So that's what I worry about, is the timing of the secular trends and how they relate to commodities as well.
So to bring that point to the equity investors out there, do we need to start looking outside U.S. borders for opportunities? I'm heavily biased. I just got back from India. In terms of an economic growth and an entrepreneurial spirit and broad participation down the cap scale in the Indian equities markets, it seems very, very different from the very narrow leadership that we're seeing in the U.S. And we've seen Brazil outperform. We've seen a lot of these countries that have a much closer reliance on the commodity space starting to outperform. Do you give any stock to looking at global equity indices?
I got to be careful because a lot of my clients are international guys. If you're a U.S. investor, no, I don't think there's a strong case yet to get over your skis. One, you got to be mindful of currency. So if you can hedge your currency exposure, sure, like Japan looks great. But if you, but on a dollar, U.S. dollar basis, Japan's not that awesome. It's really not. ETH is not that good either on a U.S. dollar perspective. So you got to be mindful of your currency exposure. So that's number one. China, the Chinese markets are broken. They're alpha, what is it, destroyers for the last 15 years. They haven't outperformed. The Chinese market's not outperformed on any real basis. And if you want to talk about a terrible breadth line, it's just as bad as Nasdaq Composites. It always goes down, right? It's just littered with companies that just show up one day and they're gone the next.
Yep.
So it's really hard for me now to say yes, to do that. Yes, there'll be opportunities here and there, of course. But I would say in a grand scheme of things, I don't see it yet. I would like to see it, but I don't see it quite yet.
Maybe before we transition to like our final questions, I have one more question for you beyond my this one, which is to just ask you to sort of, for our listeners, just summarize then what you're thinking, what you're telling clients. So it's kind of a quagmire, not really clear, bull or bear, or what are you thinking? What's leadership? What sectors are you favoring? No, you don't have to talk stocks or anything, because I know you can't. But
yeah. Well, I think what we're looking at for the next 3 to 6 months is this. Okay, we're at the end of the year. It really does look like that sentiment was washed out enough and momentum was washed out enough that we could get some sort of year-end laggard rally. That's kind of what it's starting to shape up to look like. But on the index level, it's really difficult to see a sustained gain without the macro really supporting things. And I think those trends are going to be really, really sticky. So from an S&P perspective, I'm not really terribly all that excited about it. Maybe the S&P gets to 4,500 by year end. I have a hard time seeing it sustain that. And again, my big worry is that the S&P is not only going to test the March lows, which is somewhere around 3,800, that we may have to come down and retest the October lows. But again, that's crystal ball stuff. I don't want to do that, but that's just kind of where things are kind of lining up-ish right now. So very cautious, more likely a seller of rallies as things progress. In terms of groups and whatnot, I think until year end, like I said, I think there's a laggard rally coming in that's starting to show up. I know I said I don't like China and EM, but that's a laggard area. EMFX is starting to perk up. That tends to be a tailwind for emerging markets. So I think that may be something for year end. But again, bigger picture, still like energy. I still like parts of industrials, still parts of financials, not banks. I like those areas quite a bit. Underweight healthcare in aggregate, underweight communication services and utilities.
Are you a buyer of this Head and Shoulders bottom on the ARK fund, ARK ETF?
It's interesting, buddy. Yeah, it is. I mean, I love big bases, and I cannot lie. And that does look like a big
base. It's a two-year base almost. It's almost a two-year base.
Fantastic. But you know what? It's a good risk reward, right? So like, let's not try and like guess, but like pick a side and trade it, right? So I like that idea that it is a Head and Shoulder. And then you follow the checklist of trend change approach and all that and say, okay, how am I going to build conviction in this position? Because at the end of the day, we don't know, right? And this could actually be a major inflection point for those stocks. Like to your point, Dave, they already did their bear market. Maybe they're just in a period of neglect. The NASDAQ went nowhere for a very long time.
Until the GFC, right?
Yeah, maybe that's what we're dealing with those. You know, there are great companies in there that I think in the future, but maybe as of right now, not so much. I mean, don't forget Amazon, went down 90% during when the tech bubble burst, but revenues continued to climb during that time frame. Yeah, but it was just the market didn't want to own a stock like that. And perhaps that's where some of these guys are right now, is that they're disruptors like Amazon was, but it's just the market's just not ready to appreciate them quite yet.
So, John, we've been talking about your top-down approach, understanding where markets are trending. But let's take it from the other lens, bottom-up. How do you do stock selection? What goes into the portfolio? What are the criteria?
Sure, you got it. So the first thing I learned when I was at Fidelity was that buying breakouts is a bad idea. I was coming from the sell side, and I was all about fresh breakouts, right? And it's like, oh, I want to buy this beautiful chart. It was a disaster. I couldn't have been more wrong. And what happened at Fidelity, how we got paid on our ratings, our buy and sell ratings. We also had a portfolio, a very small portfolio, right? And the reason why they gave you a portfolio was because can you actually think like a portfolio manager? It's one thing to say buy or sell, but can you construct a portfolio? Can you think like the PMs who are our internal clients, right? And what I learned pretty much like day one on the job is that there's a difference between trend and momentum. I don't think trend following works all that great when building a stock portfolio. Trend following works fine when you have a diverse set of assets, right? If you're just trading currency futures and stock futures and bond futures and all that, right? They move up, they're not highly correlated, but stocks, they are incredibly correlated. Mm. So how do you build a portfolio with technicals? I'd say that it's more about momentum. It's more about relative strength, right? So if the market is in an uptrend, right, and you have high exposure, sure, let's be in the top quintile of stocks, right? Let's do that. So I want to live in that top quintile, whatever ranking system you have. I have a ranking system. It's very similar to the momentum factor. I want to be in there. I'm focusing on those ideas. But number two, I believe in building a core satellite portfolio. You have your long-term winners, but then you sprinkle around diversifiers. I call them chart diversifiers. And in these chart diversifiers, these are ones that haven't been, they're not 52-week lows, but they're kind of basing and they're kind of waiting their turn. And you tilt a little bit more towards them when volatility is spiking, like VIX is very high, 30-ish. Credit spreads are ripping, right? This is when you're allowed to buy bad charts. Because the big problem with trend following is that it lags where? When the trend bends. Trend is your friend until it bends. That bend, there's no way to get around it, but you can try and mitigate that drawdown. So I think having chart diversifiers in there that might not necessarily be the top quintile-ish of your momentum model, whatever you have, you need to have some of them in there, because when things do turn, guess what? Those guys will help offset those that are ready to roll over. So I try to make that distinction between trend and momentum when I select stocks.
So there's like a built-in hedge to your portfolio construction.
Yeah, to an extent. Yeah, exactly. And then also you need to take into account volatility. right? Mm-hmm. So your look back period has to change as well. When markets are very volatile, you need to shorten your look back period to what should be considered in your portfolio or not. When things are really great and hunky dory, yeah, you kind of let it breathe, let it do its thing, because the look back changes. And I think folks, particularly on the quant side, don't see that. They keep things static. Mm. You want to do a 12-month look back or a 3-month, right? I think you need to adjust that. That needs to be dynamic as well. So
that was another question I was going to ask you, talking about the VIX curve or looking at volatility measures. I've had a bunch of conversations just over the last month with people who don't really trust the VIX numbers as well anymore because they're masking some of the volatility because markets are moving faster. And I spent some time with Matt Moran from CBOE talking about their new 9-day VIX and looking at a different instrument to get a sense of that volatility. Do you have multiple VIX measures?
Yeah. So I think one thing we got to realize with VIX, there's nothing wrong with VIX. VIX is not broken. Okay. Mm-hmm. VIX, 80% of VIX is derived off of realized vol, off of the rate of change itself, right? Mm-hmm. So VIX is almost the absolute rate of change of price. It's mm-hmm. basically what it is. This decline that we've had, right, has been orderly. We haven't mm-hmm. had very many back-to-back 1.5% or 2% days. It has yet to be a waterfall. Mm-hmm. People's personal VIX is at 80. Why? Because their portfolios look like crap because the average stock is trending the wrong way.
Yep.
But the actual VIX of the market ain't that bad. Why? Because it's been an orderly decline. That actually could be a bullish argument that this has just been a low vol, higher trending market, essentially, right? Where vol's contracting, you're creating a big bull flag and the market rips and volatility expands again. But I don't know if it's necessarily broken. Now, again, too, how do I look at VIX? I think spot VIX is the wrong way to look at it. You got to look at the futures for it. You got to look at the first contract on that. Spot VIX doesn't trade, right? There's no psychological component to that. Number two, you look at the curve.
Yeah.
VIX, the VVIX. Front month and maybe second. And that inverted very briefly about a week ago. So where are we now? November 2nd-ish. It was right around when the market bottomed when it came down and just undercut the 200-day moving average of the S&P. That is a useful signal when the curve inverts.
Brilliant.
Okay, last question for me. I like to dig into hobbies that you're maybe hobbies or other things, you know, interests outside of markets, just to see if you can share any lessons learned while deploying your interest into that hobby. And I think anybody that knows you well knows that you're a huge Star Wars fan. You know, what has Yoda taught you about investing and trading? Luke,
are we really going this way? All right, fine. We'll talk Star Wars. No, it's you know what? You know what? I think Star Wars, you can learn a lot from those movies.
Yeah, it's very philosophical.
Incredibly. So a couple of things I would say is that remember, there will always be dark times, okay? Don't back down and don't give up your dreams. That's one thing. That's one thing I've always learned from Star Wars, right? Don't give up on those things. Be rebellious, right? And as overwhelming as things may be, remember, size matters not, right? Stay on target. Yeah. Stay balanced and don't give in to hate, right? Don't be over emotional. So when it comes to investing, right, who would be a good stock picker, right? It would probably, outside of C-3PO, right, he would be pretty good because he knows all the odds. But yeah. he's got no human feeling to it. So I don't think he would be great. It would probably be something like Yoda because he's also clairvoyant. We like that,
yeah.
right?
But yeah.
But he's not like Kylo Ren, who is emo and freaks out all the time. Yeah. And it wouldn't also be Han Solo because Han Solo is a gambler, right? Mm. So we wouldn't want that. So that's what I would learn from Star Wars.
Well, John, as we wrap up today's interview and let you get going here, markets just closed, and I know for all of our listeners, they're going to be on the edge of their seats and thinking about how they're going to manage risk effectively and responsibly here through the end of the year. Really appreciate you spending some time with Dave and I, and looking forward to seeing you very, very soon, my friend.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President.
Yeah, technically you're our boss, right?
Yeah.
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 Just not at the bowling alley. That's where we own you.
why do we have to go there? Why do we have to go there?
Right at the end, too.
And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I look forward to seeing you all at the next episode of Fill the Gap, the official podcast of the CMT Association. Thanks so much, John.
Fill the Gap is brought to you with support from Optima. In addition to candidate study of the official CMT curriculum, Optima provides a full video course on all of the material that candidates need to know for each level of the CMT exams. Each course is broken up into modules ranging from 15 to 45 minutes, depending on the complexity and length of the topics being covered. Learn more at Optima.com.